This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Chris Peacock of Lexington grew up as part of a classic American football family. Now she's not letting any of her four kids play the game.
He really did want to play football. He really wanted to be a running back and play. And it was a hard discussion, but we just had to be the parents.
Chris Peacock is not alone. Eric Stock reports on the cloudy future of football. Plus, the state budget crisis slashed nonprofit agencies to the bone, and the ones that are left still have not recovered. Ryan Denham reports they're trying to find their way into new collaborations to keep the missions alive. John Norton brings you the music of Brett Conlon, and Illinois Symphony music director Ken Lamb previews the first concert of the new season. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The two-year state budget crisis made life difficult for many of the 100,000 nonprofits across Illinois that rely in some way on taxpayer support. For nonprofits, that uncertainty made the idea of collaborating with other nonprofits more tempting, either to save money or potentially to bring in more in grants. An association of Illinois nonprofits called Forefront is hosting a conference in Normal Tuesday focused on such collaborations. Forefront's Director of Statewide Partnerships, Sarah Tapscott, says it's an extension of a two-year-old initiative.
Yes, we have a budget, but I think our nonprofits are still feeling some of those pains. And just like with any kind of initiative, you try to, you launch and then you try to scale it. And so we're just at that point now where we are able to begin these conversations downstate. And so the summit that we're having next Tuesday is just the beginning of those conversations around partnerships and collaboration.
When you say partnerships and collaborations, so what's an example of a collaboration that's been particularly successful, kind of a poster child for what you want nonprofit leaders to kind of take away from this conference?
Partnerships and collaborations, has a mixed feelings around it, and even understanding what the definition is of collaboration. And so some people, think that collaborating with other organizations might mean that, I refer a client to you, or maybe we sit on a same board together. And then, to the extreme, some nonprofits think when you're talking about collaborations that you are only thinking of a merger example and, somebody's going to lose their job. Collaborations are on a continuum. So there's the piece of just, referring all the way to the merger and then everything in between. And so for our event on Tuesday, we are having a panel discussion, and what we have done is we have brought in different individuals, different organizations who have gone through some kind of a strategic partnership. One that we are highlighting actually is coming from Bloomington Children's Discovery Museum and the town of Normal, and how that whole process took place and how they're thriving now. And we're having somebody actually from the Discovery Museum who was there from day one of this whole process come and talk about that situation. So we wanted to make sure that we provided and highlighted, different examples. Some took many years to go through this process, while some just took a few months. And so we want to make sure that those who come understand that there are definitely different stages different levels, and different opportunities to go through this process.
What are some of the barriers to collaboration? I mean, I guess why isn't there more of it happening already? What are the reasons that you know, need a conference like this to promote the concept?
I think it's, you know, a variety of things. So when you look at the nonprofit sector in Illinois, there's over 105,000 plus, you know, nonprofits operating in Illinois, and everyone is doing such good work. But some of the things, when you think about the challenges or the barriers, is it's almost, you know, the uncertainty or unknown of even how to go about, you know, doing this process. And so one of the things that we've done in the Chicago area when we launched this 2 years ago was some funders who were very interested in this field pulled together some of their resources to support nonprofits financially to have some resources to consider this opportunity. You know, consultants to come in and even talk to your board or to your organization about what does this mean, what does this look like. That costs money. And so I would say one of the barriers, again, is just not knowing even when or how to start the conversation. The second one, I would say, is probably just nonprofits not knowing what each other are doing necessarily, or even that another nonprofit is potentially struggling in an area that maybe another nonprofit struggling in. One of the things that is so important when you think about collaboration is partnerships and relationships with each other. And so if nonprofits aren't out building, you know, their own networks, they're not able to even begin to even know what is out there. And, you know, that's a challenge in itself, given the fact that we are in the situation we are with, you know, lack of funding. Some nonprofits don't even have the luxury of being able to go out for coffee with another colleague because they're, you know, at their desk working and, you know, making sure that the lights are staying on. So I definitely think that that is a challenge, too, is just being able to have the conversation about what successful collaborations would look like if you don't have some of those pre-existing relationships. Mm. And so one of the ways that, you know, Forefront tries to initiate or create an environment for those relationships to happen is, you know, we have different networks set up throughout the state based on, you know, service area, focus area, geographic area, or even, you know, different staff positions at the organization to help encourage those kinds of relationship building opportunities.
The identity of a nonprofit is very important. So I wonder whether or not there's ever skittishness among nonprofit leaders that, you know, folding themselves in with another group might lower their profile somehow and maybe hurt their ability to raise money independently. Do you ever find that that's a concern for a nonprofit who's thinking about a collaboration but isn't pulling the trigger?
Oh, I think so. I think you definitely, you know, nailed that one, especially given the whole reason that a nonprofit exists is because they are mission-based. And so, you know, you think about, well, if I merge or if we partner or something, will a piece of our you know, organization or program be in jeopardy or, you know, or something will be lacking? And I definitely think that is something that nonprofits do kind of keep in the back of their mind. And again, but, you know, we're hoping that organizations aren't thinking about partnering or collaborating with organizations that don't have similar missions necessarily or that wouldn't benefit the clients or those that they're serving, that they would be kind of like organizations. You know, we're definitely thinking nonprofits should consider new and creative ways of working together, which does not come easily. But we definitely, you know, hope and encourage that, you know, that the organizations will at least come together aligned behind some sort of common goal, so that way they're both achieving, you know, those same kind of outcomes or indicators.
Well, what about financial advantages to collaboration? I imagine there are certain efficiencies that you could find, but another kind of related question is, does collaboration ever make a nonprofit or nonprofits more attractive for potential grants? Like, do you find there are foundations that are more prone to give away money to nonprofits if they are collaborating together in some way?
100%. And in fact, we're seeing that more common now that funders are asking within their grant applications, who are you partnering with? Who are you collaborating with? Some are even putting out collaborative grant opportunities, you know, requiring that your organization and another organization apply for funding together. Funders are asking for, you know, sort of the same results for children and youth. So why wouldn't some of the youth-serving organizations come together? For example, Girl Scouts and an organization called Girls on the Run, who, you know, are very similar in terms of, you know, wanting to encourage girls' self-esteem and empowerment. And so how awesome would it be if those two organizations, you know, we're not talking merged together, but somehow came together to collaborate and to partner on measuring these same outcomes, and then they could apply for funding together based on, you know, shared data, shared resources, and probably have a better opportunity of receiving, you know, a higher level of funding based on that sort of collaborative grant opportunity. But, you know, we've been approached by a few funders over the last few years or so, because, you know, Forefront, we're a membership organization made up of nonprofits and foundations. And so sometimes foundations will come to us and say, you know, we've got this grant opportunity, you know, can you promote, can you share? And I've seen, you know, a few of them come across that, you know, require collaboration amongst the nonprofit organizations in order to even attempt to submit a letter of intent.
This conference you have coming up on October 23rd, you're doing it in partnership with Illinois State University's Center for Community Engagement and Service Learning. It's a relatively new center here on campus. So how did that relationship come about, and why was the center at ISU kind of a good partner for what you're trying to do?
We wanted an event in the Central Illinois area, and Bloomington Normal is a great location. So I reached out to them, seeing if they wanted to partner on this, because I knew, again, it was definitely something within their mission. And so they have been, you know, on board 100%, helping to promote this, work with the university. And so, yeah, it was just, you know, one of those opportunities through networking that I was able to build the relationship with the department, and now we're hosting this event next Tuesday.
That's Sarah Tapscott from the nonprofit association Forefront, speaking with GLT's Ryan Denham. Forefront is organizing a conference for nonprofits focused on collaboration on Tuesday at Illinois State University's Bone Student Center. It's co-sponsored by ISU's year-old Center for Community Engagement and Service Learning.
Support for GLT comes from TEDx Normal, an independently organized local TED event enriching the Bloomington Normal community with ideas worth sharing. Held at the Center for Performing Arts on ISU's campus, Saturday, October 27th, 9 to noon. Tickets available at TEDxNormal.net. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, the music of Brett Conlon is brought to you by John Norton. High school parents have made football a part of their Friday nights as long as anyone can remember, but in recent years, participation in the sport has dropped noticeably. Concerns about player safety and socioeconomic factors raise worries about the sport's long-term prospects, especially in communities with deep football traditions and culture. GLT's Eric Stock examines the future of high school football, efforts to make the game safer, and how schools and communities are adjusting.
As you drive into the small farming community of Lexington, you quickly get a sense for the town's pride in its school and its sports teams. A large sign off the main road trumpets its athletic achievements, 15 state championships in high school and junior high sports. On a cold, windy, and rainy night in September, fans from all over northern McLean County, including rival El Paso Gridley, make their way to Lexington High School to take part in a Friday night ritual that's as much religion as it is sport in much of America.
Welcome, everyone, to Lexington for the home opener for the Lexington Ridgeview Mustangs.
It's a special night in Lexington because the football game their team is about to play is the only game Lexington will host all season. That's because Lexington no longer has a team of its own. 6 years after the Minutemen played in the state championship game, and 4 years after its star quarterback Alex Tanney was drafted into the National Football League, the school, which boasted 5 state title game appearances, no longer had enough players to field its own team. Eager to hold on to the sport, Lexington agreed to co-op arrangements with the 2 consolidated school districts, Ridgeview and Blue Ridge, so students who want to play football ride the bus an additional 40 minutes each day just to practice, just to have a football team. The 3-school co-op lasted just 1 season. Coach Jay Kennedy took over the program in 2016 after 3 straight winless seasons at Ridgeview, where he served as an assistant. The job was open for 3 months and no one applied before the athletic director applied some pressure on him to take the job.
Rodney had actually said, you know, Jake, if you take the head coach, I'll be the offense coordinator. I said, okay, I'll work with you, Coach Keller. We coached together for 12 years now. Well, I took the head job, and he backed out as the offense coordinator.
Ridgeview has since dropped Blue Ridge from the co-op because it became too cumbersome, but Kennedy has actually increased numbers in the football program. Ridgeview started the season with 53 players in all high school levels, with 16 of them from Lexington.
The cliche is, oh, if you win, kids will come out. Well, that's not always true because, you know, we've only been 3-6. I think if you get the right kids to come out, they'll bring other kids with them. And then there's a vibe, and then there's energy in your schools about, hey, football's good to go. Like, you should play it. And cool kids are playing football.
Kennedy adds he still has to allay concerns from parents who are worried about their child suffering a concussion.
But that could happen in basketball. It could happen in soccer. You can take a fastball to the head in baseball. You're going to get concussed. I mean, if it happens, it happens. It's no different than a broken ankle or a broken leg doing any other sport. But it is a tough sell right now in football. That's kind of the elephant in the room.
While the co-op between former rivals has kept football alive in both communities, to some it has still diminished the community's sense of identity.
The fence mending, it's been good. And it's like anything. You're going to have your established people that they don't want to see change. But you hope that as you sell it and kids are more taking part of it and the communities come together, that will go away. But it will never 100% be gone.
Jamie Farrell is president of the Lexington Booster Club and was a cheerleader during her days at the high school. Her son played in the last Lexington football team as a freshman in 2014, but decided not to return after the co-op was formed.
Getting used to it, getting used to the new normal, getting used to the fact that Lexington doesn't have a football team, it's a challenge. So, you know, it's just tough right now, you know, but hopefully people are going to start to buy into it a little bit more.
As Farrell helped set up food and drinks at the concession stand prior to kickoff, Farrell said she longs for the day that fans will see the Ridgeview Lexington Mustangs as their own.
People just aren't coming out like they used to and stuff. So I hope that we can, you know, kind of bring it back and people get a little bit more used to it, more comfortable with it.
The transition may be easier for some families who are less invested in the community's past. Polly Walcott grew up in Peoria before moving to Lexington in 2000 to raise her children. Her son Tate plays in the football team and is a state champion long jumper. She admits it was easier for her to see the practical benefits of the co-op because she lacked the strong connection many in the community had with Lexington's high school. Still, she and her family wondered if it was time to explore other options as the school's enrollment continued to dwindle and athletic opportunities were jeopardized.
So there was a time when they were talking about us consolidating with whoever and years ago, and we thought, do we need to move? Do we want to try to find a new town to go to? And no, we wanted to stay here. We like Lexington.
Son Tate Walcott quit football after his freshman year to his mother's relief. When friends talked him into rejoining the team for his senior season, she worried he would get hurt and risk his scholarship potential as a track standout.
Oh, yeah. I have some hesitation now. I mean, it's constant prayers that he won't get hurt. I enjoy watching him play, but, you know, there's there's some concern.
While hopes are much higher this season at Ridgeview, the Mustangs were assured of at least one win. Their first opponent, Rockford Our Lady of the Sacred Heart Academy, had to forfeit its entire season because the tiny school of 20 students doesn't have enough to field a football team. More school districts like Lexington and Ridgeview are forming cooperatives as a way to have enough student-athletes to field a team, but even co-ops aren't enough in some places. Flanagan's high school football program pulls in students from three school districts. Yet in a game in early October, the Falcons had to quit at halftime because they didn't have enough players after several got injured and several others had recently quit the team. The National Federation of State High School Associations reports football participation has dropped 17% in Illinois over the last 5 years, and there are 18 fewer high schools sponsoring football. Many schools in Illinois are dealing with enrollment issues on a broader scale. Illinois has an out-migration problem, one of the worst in the country, and many rural school districts are bearing the brunt of that exodus, whether they are moving out of state or just into a larger city. And while McLean County's population has marginally grown since the 2010 census, many rural school districts are shrinking. Six of the eight public school districts based in McLean County have seen decreased enrollment in the last 15 years. Even after they absorbed students from two school districts that no longer exist, Shenoah was annexed into the Prairie Central School District in 2004. Gridley merged with El Paso that same year. Rural schools have seen the largest drops in K-12 enrollment since 2002. Olympia's headcount down nearly 26%. Lexington has fallen 19%, and Ridgeview's enrollment down 15%. It's been said that if the mothers of America wanted, they could kill football on their own, simply by taking their children off the field or never letting them on it in the first place. It appears a growing number of parents aren't letting their children play what is still the most popular spectator sport in the U.S. Chris Peacock of Lexington grew up in the classic American football family. She and her dad spent every fall Sunday watching their beloved Chicago Bears.
Mike Ditka, hungry Chicago, finally champions.
Her brother quarterbacked the Lexington High School team into the state playoffs in the early 90s. But over the last decade, her sentiments toward the game she once loved changed as she read more reports about ex-players suffering from brain injuries.
The stories of some, you know, junior stay-out, there's been some college kids who've had difficulties with mental illness and committing suicide and from the CTE, and it just kind of ruins the fun after a while.
Sayal was an NFL Hall of Fame linebacker who committed suicide in 2012. Doctors determined Sayal suffered from chronic brain damage. Chris and her husband, Paul, came to the decision they wouldn't let any of their four kids play football. She says it was a difficult conversation telling their oldest son, Ben, a multi-sport athlete, that he wouldn't play.
He really did want to play football. He really wanted to be a running back and play. And it was a hard discussion, but we just had to be the parents, and we just had to say no. It wasn't going to be his decision.
Peacock says her son found joy in soccer, track, and basketball without as many health risks.
No regrets at all. He's great at soccer. He's great at basketball. I think he's getting a lot of fulfillment from those sports. And I think, you know, there's always going to be risks, but I think the risks are lower in those sports.
As for their younger boys working their way through grade school, even flag football won't be an option for them.
I totally would support flag football, except I feel like that's a gateway to real football, so we've been steering them away from that.
Flag football, by design, is a gateway to tackle football. Most young people who start playing the non-tackle version end up playing tackle football later. If youth football is the foundation on which the sport is built, the game is still on solid ground in Bloomington Normal, which has had a thriving program for decades. Children and their parents can easily be drawn to the Friday Night Lights atmosphere. At Ewing Park 2, where the Bloomington Cardinals play their home games, helmet-clad kids ages 8 to 13, decked out in full shoulder pads, engage in their ritualistic pep talks, mimicking the ones they see on television, then storm onto the field by tearing through a sign. Amid thick, fake red smoke, and AC/DC pumping in the background, and cheerleaders capturing the attention of cheering fans who camp under tents lining the field in all directions. At White Oak Park, where the Bloomington Knockers play their home games, an inflated helmet is their prop of choice as players enter the field. Knockers director Brian Segabiano is the third generation in his family that has helped keep the Knockers in business for more than 60 years. He says it's all part of the game and fan experience that has helped keep youth football so popular, even as more parents express worries about their children's safety. Segabiano says he wants to take a proactive approach.
You address it. You don't bury your head in the sand. You say, okay, there's a concern. What are the things that they have some valid points about? And you address it because it's an important sport to us. It's taught a lot of us a lot of lessons outside of the field.
Segabiano says youth football in Bloomington Normal has banned kickoffs, a play considered one of the most dangerous in the game because of the risk for full-speed collisions. He adds that coaches are teaching safer tackling techniques, specifically avoiding helmet contact when possible. Lyle Edwards and his wife Diane have been running the Bloomington Cardinals youth football program for decades. He believes the game is safer than it's ever been, but doesn't believe better helmets are the answer.
I don't care what kind of helmet you buy. Helmets are only designed for incidental contact. They're not designed to use as a battering ram. The two things happen. You can get a concussion that way, or you can get a neck injury.
Edward says in the 1970s and 80s, neck injuries were far more common because players often led with their head. Diane Edwards jokes she's the Cardinals' co-director by marriage. She says the kids in the program all submit to baseline concussion tests that include a neurocognitive assessment that's used to determine whether a child is safe to return to play after a potential head injury.
We also offer our kids impact testing every year. The Cardinals pay for that because we think it's that important.
Lyle Edwards suggests much of the fear over football is simply a fear of the unknown, which he likened to the public's misunderstanding about guns.
All the younger people don't own guns. All the younger people are concerned about the health of their kids. The older people are when we all die out and understand if you teach somebody how to use a gun right, it's safe. If you teach somebody how to play football right, it's safer. It's not safe. Nothing is safe.
Edwards laments ongoing efforts to change football will eventually lead to a game either changing beyond recognition or going away altogether.
I think someday it'll be gone. I don't think I'll see it.
But he says that would be a shame.
What do you want them to do if you don't have youth sports? You want to sit them in front of a TV and play video games? That's not good. You want them just running around the neighborhood, out in front of cars.
When coaches or school administrators in McLean County have medical concerns about concussions, they call Edward Pegg III. Dr. Pegg is a Bloomington-based neurologist at OSF St. Joseph Medical Center and runs a private practice. Pegg says he first became interested in studying links between football and head injuries when his son played at Normal West High School.
I actually witnessed Ed having a concussion on the field. He wasn't knocked out, but when I saw him walking towards the goalpost rather than back to the huddle, I knew, you know, something was going on.
Pegg has been providing concussion baseline tests for youth, high school, and college football players in Bloomington, Normal, and beyond for years. His son, Dr. Edward Pegg IV, followed in his father's footsteps into neurology. And in 2015, he presented research to the American Academy of Neurology. He studied brain scans of retired NFL players and neuropsychiatric evaluations of retirees who had suffered repeated concussions to detect changes in their brain's health. Pegg IV says the MRIs revealed changes in brain activity likely resulted from multiple head injuries.
Having repeated head trauma over a period of years is probably not good in the long term.
The senior Pegg is a season ticket holder for Illinois State football, but says he's not a hardcore fan. He acknowledges the health risks that football can pose, but he believes the constant drumbeat from the media about concussions has caused the pendulum to swing too far in the other direction.
You know, if we've got a lot of henny pennies out there, you know, freaking out about every little thing that happens, it may not swing back to the middle.
Pegg believes most pro football players have likely suffered anywhere from 20 to 50 undiagnosed concussions in their careers, a number that someone playing only high school or college will likely never reach.
You hear all the bad things and nobody has gone, now look, these are 300-plus pound players that are slamming into each other at over 15 miles an hour. I mean, that's a lot more of, you know, causes the brain to slosh around a lot more.
The senior Pegg acknowledges he'd prefer to see kids waiting until they're older to play football. That's a decision the younger Pegg will soon face. He has three young children now all playing soccer, and Pegg says he hopes they stay with soccer. If his 7-year-old son decides he wants to play football,
I think I would be okay with that. I think that, you know, if he was showing that he was having repetitive injuries, then I'd be like, well, we got to rethink this. But to play, you know, in high school is one thing. To do it as a lifelong career, I would be a little bit more hesitant to, you know, encourage that.
While the effects football has on the brain may never be fully known, perceptions about the sport's dangers have the attention of the Illinois High School Association, the privately run organization which oversees high school sports in the state. Craig Anderson is its executive director. His devotion to football runs deep. He played in the sport from sixth grade through college. He later coached football at the high school level and coached his own kids in youth football. Anderson believes caretakers of the game have made great strides to make it safer.
I can honestly sit here and say I think the game's the safest it's ever been in terms of equipment and technique and the things that our coaches are doing to protect kids.
The IHSA has also limited full contact drills during practices. Anderson acknowledges concerns about players' safety are likely the driving force in reducing participation in football, but he suggests increased specialization of younger athletes has prompted more of them to focus on one sport year-round in hopes of earning a college scholarship.
When there's money being invested, then there's somebody making money out of it. So, you know, those trainers are promoting those kids to come and participate in these out of our high school season leagues and development plans or programs that, you know, kids might find their ways to get better, but, you know, they're losing out on opportunities to participate for their high school.
Few football coaches are more familiar with the challenges facing high schools than Mike Castleman. He coached Lexington's last football team and is now the athletic director at Olympia High School, yet another rural district with a shrinking population. He says he has seen high school football suffer from many student-athletes only wanting to play one sport with the thought it would make them more successful. Castleman considers that flawed thinking. He says spending too much time on one sport is often counterproductive to becoming a complete athlete.
Ohio State a couple years ago had a thing where it was 90 to 95% of their squad were all multi-sport athletes in high school. It's what the next level is looking for, but for some reason we're not getting on board with that.
The increased specialization of youth in high school sports has increased injury risks, according to Cynthia LaBella, professor of pediatrics at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. She spoke to IPR's The 21st.
There are a few studies that suggest that, especially with sports that require repetition of one specific movement over and over again to perfect a skill. So there is some concern that overuse injuries are becoming more prevalent because there is not as much downtime for the body to repair tissues and recover and heal.
The increased likelihood of injuries can lead to an increased likelihood of litigation. Hundreds, if not thousands, of lawsuits have been filed against university athletic programs claiming schools lack proper concussion protocols. Joe Walters is in his first season as head coach at Central Catholic High School in Bloomington. Walters cautioned that a legal challenge of some kind could accelerate more drastic changes to the game.
You know, it could happen overnight if there was some type of significant change and we weren't able to obtain insurance anymore. otherwise. I do think it will slowly, and I think that's our responsibility as adults and coaches, that we got to protect our players and our children. So if we're not doing that, well, then shame on us.
The IHSA requires any athlete showing signs of a possible concussion to be taken off the field until a school-approved healthcare provider deems them safe to return to play. A growing number of schools are turning to 8-man football as a viable alternative to the 11-player game. A majority of states offer a scaled-down version of the game. Some offer 6-on-6, others 9-on-9. Illinois currently has 6 schools sponsoring 8-man football. Many are in border communities, as teams often have to travel out of state to Indiana, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Iowa to find opponents. Anderson believes 8-man football could have a future in Illinois, but added it would likely take at least 30 participating schools before the IHSA would officially recognize it as a championship sport.
We're going to monitor the growth of 8-man football, and when it seems like the participation numbers for teams make sense for our board to consider a state series in 8-man football, we'll probably will.
Mike Castleman says Olympia's football program is starting to rebound. In a new co-op with Delavan, the Spartans recently picked up their first victory since 2015. But he acknowledged the uphill battle his program and the sport faces long-term. Aside from the threat of injuries, Castleman worries some young people are turned off playing football simply because of the commitment that's required.
I don't want to offend anybody with anything, but, you know, football is it's hard. It just is. The preparation is hard. It's a hard game to play. And some people, for the choices that they have, just are not willing to do that.
Castleman adds those sacrifices he made playing football in high school and college were well worth it.
When I talk with guys from high school, I don't mean to offend the math teachers, but we don't talk about what happened in math class. We talked about football, and we still do these many years later.
But athletic administrators know there is one math problem they will have to solve. If current participation declines in football continue, in 30 years, sounds like this might become sounds of the past. I'm Eric Stahl.
High school football enrollment in Illinois has dropped 17% in the last 3 years. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from the Multicultural Leadership Program, developing diverse servant leaders who enrich our community with outstanding leadership at work and through local nonprofits. MCLP's Pass It Forward Day of Giving is October 23rd. Details at bn-mclp.org/give. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, the Illinois Symphony Orchestra starts its season. Bloomington's Brett Conlon cuts hair and writes songs. Occasionally, conversations at his Lone Wolf Barbershop in downtown Bloomington find their way into his folk punk alt-country music. Conlon performs at Night Shop in Bloomington tomorrow evening as part of the venue's songwriter series. He dropped by GLT Studios recently to talk about his music with John Norton. Conlon says barbershop conversations aren't his main source material.
But there's definitely bits and pieces that float in there, you know, sometimes between somebody just talking about loss or like a great moment in their life, or just a really like funny, interesting story that they've shared with me about traveling around, or just something that their parents or grandparents used to do with them or talk to them about or something like that.
Well, let's talk about some of your songs. And I want to focus on Glad to See You Go, the album that came out, 2-3 years ago now?
Yeah, 3 years ago this December.
Fantastic album.
Thank you.
Let's go with the song Hard, Hard Life.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me it's like a life's progression, right? From being carefree as a young person to now you have a child, from a great life of irresponsibility to someone who has to be responsible now.
Yeah.
We get off the work round the corner past 5. It's going to be a good life. Your pockets are full, you won't go hungry tonight. It's going to be a good life.
I wouldn't say it's like 100% my life, but that was kind of the progression so far. My son's 6 now. I have a daughter that's 2. And I think when I wrote that song, my son was still pretty young, but I had transitioned from being a young, carefree person to now I'm like working this warehouse job and trying to make ends meet and go to school at the same time and write music and try to, so you're in this world of working world but also music world of fun and trying to do both at the same time.
Now maybe you think you're what you need will change from day to day. Maybe you think you're overpaid, yeah. Keep living simple, what do you say?
You reference your six-year-old who is in school today.
He's in school today.
How much did that change your outlook and your songwriting?
A lot. There's a couple songs probably on the album that are very geared towards that and reflective of that. Home on Time, I think when I tell that story live, there's really not much of a story to tell. It's, hey, like this song's called Home on Time. It's about not being home on time and feeling like you're constantly disappointing your son or whoever you're trying to get back to.
3 a.m. Am I alone on this interstate? I should be sleeping. It's so late.
It's definitely changed the way that I do shows and travel around and stuff like that. It's a lot in the past I would play a show, maybe hang out, stay the night with somebody. Now it's kind of like it's 1, 2 in the morning and the show's over. And I'm like, you know what? I got to go back because he's going to want to wake up at 6 a.m. and hang out and do whatever. So
you got him really into music by now?
Yeah, he's got a drum set.
Nice.
So we'll sit down in the basement where I've got all the music stuff and we'll play. I'll kind of ask him, you know, what kind of song do you want to play? And sometimes he'll be like rock and roll, like loud. So I'll just play a super loud, fast riff and he'll come in with whatever. And then actually last time we played, he surprised me. He's like, play something really quiet. And he was like doing all this stuff on the toms, like, you know, just kind of trying to do something real moody. And I was like, all right, I don't know what you're going for here, dude. But well,
he's got some game, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Got a feel. All right.
Yeah.
We're talking with Bloomington Normal singer-songwriter Brett Conlon. He's part of the Songwriter Series at Night Shop on October 20th. This is GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton. Let's go to the title track, Glad to See You Go.
When the life that you know is a pot that's gone cold with troubles all
not taking anything for granted, it sounds like.
Yeah, for sure. A friend of mine moved with his girlfriend out to the East Coast and kind of just hit the reset button on his life. And I thought that was really cool. And I think they definitely needed that. A lot of people have had that moment in their life where they've seen a friend or a family member that they were used to hanging out with every day and kind of grew up with. And then they're like, all right, well, now maybe we'll see you once a year or whenever.
So if you go in my way, I'll walk with you home. And if you're feeling low down, we'll pass the bottle around.
The song is called Glad to See You Go. It's a title track from the album by Brett Conlon. This is GLT Sound Ideas. You also front a punk band.
Yeah, that's a recent development.
Dead End Lights.
Yeah, yeah, it's been super fun. That's the stuff that I grew up with, was playing in punk rock bands and stuff like that. I played bass for a long time in bands like that.
Well, let me play just a little snippet of a song, the song called Daggers.
Mm-hmm.
I know it's hard.
I hear Dropkick Murphys in this song so much.
Yeah, they were one of the first bands that I got into when I was younger. I remember seeing Flogging Molly once at Warped Tour, where they do the whole Irish punk thing, and that was cool to hear all of that come together.
Did you grow up on punk music?
No. At my mom's house, I used to listen to just kind of whatever they listened to, which was like, I remember my stepdad listening to Steely Dan a lot, and my mom listened to, she liked little groovy stuff. I remember dancing to CNC Music Factory with her when I was a kid.
Oh.
And at my dad's house, it was like a lot of classic rock, a lot of like old school country stuff that his dad listened to. And so there was like all this stuff when I was a kid, but you don't really ever develop your own taste, I think, until you're maybe like 13, 14 years old.
Well, what stuck with you when you were young? Was it the classic rock?
Yeah, classic rock was good. I remember sitting in like my dad's car one day, and he ran in the house to get something. And not that this song is heavy, but I heard Dream On by Aerosmith, and I was just like, yeah, that rocks. That's cool. Whatever that is, I want to know more about that. Huh. You know, because at that time I was listening to whatever a kid in fifth grade listens to, Hootie and the Blowfish or something, probably.
Well, let's go back to another song from your album, Glad to See You Go. Everything I Know is the song I'm getting at. Let me play just a little bit of it here.
So, bartender, yeah, one more round. Lord knows I got the time. Yes, I've done everything I know to get you off my mind.
So this is an interesting song. You've got a male-female perspective going back and forth.
Yeah.
Pearls Malone gets the credit. Who's Pearls Malone? I'm guessing that's a pseudonym.
Pearls Malone is she's like a Western swing rockabilly artist up in Chicago. I wrote part of that song, and I was kind of like, I feel like this needs something else. It needs like a kind of back and forth perspective, definitely a female perspective too. So I got a hold of her, and we met up at her house one day and kind of messed around with it. Wrote some lyrics, and then we got everything together for the album. It was like, here's your time. Come sing way better than I can.
Singer-songwriter Brett Conlon's our guest on GLT Sound Ideas. One more song before I let you go.
Sure.
Dancing in the Dark.
Yeah.
You covered Bruce Springsteen. It was just a few months ago you put this out.
That was a bold move.
I get up in the evening, and I ain't got nothing to say. Come home in the morning. I go to bed feeling the same way. I ain't nothing but tired.
So you say you took a chance.
I did. I recorded it, and I remember playing part of it for my girlfriend, and she's like, it's really sad.
I know.
It's awesome. It's awesome how sad it sounds.
You can't start a fire without a spark. This gun's for hire. Even if we're just dancing in the dark.
What was the chance?
Just taking the chance, I think just covering Springsteen, that's a huge thing to do. I'm really happy with the way it turned out. I like doing it. I like that it was kind of a, you listen to the lyrics and it's kind of a desperate song about not liking who you are or wanting to be a better person or just really saying like, hey, you know, maybe I'm not happy with something, but I'm going to find something to make me happy.
Want to change my clothes, my hair, my face.
Bloomington singer-songwriter Brett Conlon speaking with GLT's John Norton. Conlon performs at Night Shop in downtown Bloomington tomorrow evening as part of the songwriter series. Grant Milleron also performs. Discover more local music and hear from artists playing in Central Illinois on the GLT Music Podcast. Find it on NPR One or your favorite podcast app.
Broken heart, this gun's for hire. Even if we're just dancing in the dark.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The Illinois Symphony Orchestra begins its season this evening at the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts. Ken Lamb begins his second season as music director with the Joan Tower Work Fanfare for the Uncommon Woman. Tower started composing in the 1960s in an era when it was difficult to be a female classical composer. She's one of the first women in the contemporary era to find her voice in classical music. Ken Lamb tells us how he views that voice.
This is one of the first Joan Tower pieces that I've done. And I find it, you know, very, I think it's a very neat piece. Of course, you know, this particular piece, the Fanfare for the Uncommon Woman, I put it deliberately against Copland's Lincoln Portrait, because, of course, it was sort of inspired or at least influenced by the Fanfare for the Common Man. And it uses the same instrumentation. It's sort of fanfare-like. It is a fanfare, after all. But of course, it has everything in it that is American about it.
Mm-hmm.
As you probably know, Copland was, I guess Bernstein called him the Dean of American Music. And it was really around Copland's, you know, in the 20s and 30s, with composers like Copland and Roy Harris, that really the American classical music tradition took shape. You know, before that, you know, you have people like Chad Wake, who took on, just basically copied the European masters. And then for a while we had Dvorak suggesting that we use, you know, spirituals as a basis of American music. And then Gershwin was jazz. Now, Charles Ives is out there somewhere.
But way out there somewhere.
But I think many would agree that it was really around Roy Harris and Copland that really found this sort of the openness of the harmony, you know, the fourths and fifths, yeah. That when you hear that, you immediately say that sounded American. And
the grace notes to that would be Barber and Hanson, maybe.
Absolutely. And also, it's amazing that how that those open intervals remind us of the vast landscapes of the Midwest. And I think Joan Tower in the Fend for the Uncommon Woman sort of nodded to that, because if you look at the way she put it together, it's also a lot of open intervals used in her own way.
Ken Lamb is the music director of the Illinois Symphony Orchestra performing this evening in Bloomington. The other major work on the program is Beethoven's Ode to Joy. This is WGLT Normal.